Thank you for joining us on this episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett, where we examine current and emerging technologies through the lens of diversity and equality.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of Eminent Teachnology with Dr. Rochelle Newton and Drew Stennett. Today, we are going to be talking about trends in technology. So we got, I think we got a bunch to talk through. I bet we will get through maybe two or three if we go on our normal pace. But yeah, that's what we're going to be talking about today. Rochelle, in the first article you sent me, the most interesting one to me, and this is one that I feel like we're living in sci-fi times, is quantum computing. Like quantum computing being, I don't know. I feel like for our listeners that don't know, I will try to explain it in a like very someone who majored in theater can explain because it's very confusing. All computer things are based on binary, which is, you know, a zero or a one, which means like a switch is either off or it's on. And those combinations of off and on make up like the logic of all computers, using things that are people that are way smarter than me have figured out with all this like binary stuff. But, you know, our modern day computers all break down into a one or a zero. And with quantum computing uses the, I want to say theory, but I guess it's not a theory anymore. It's a fact, is that things can be off or on, or they can be like in this Schrodinger's box state of you haven't observed it, so you don't know whether it's off or on yet. So it is both off and on. So now everything can have three states, off, on, and both. And because of that, because like all of these are like, you know, things that used to be theories, like, you know, they've probably been facts for longer than I realized, but they still seem very science fiction. Now, instead of having a building blocks that can be zero or one, now they can be zero, one, or both, which like blows modern computing out of the water, because now you've just got more data that you can use in the same amount of space.
Absolutely. And quantum computing has been around for a very, very long time. People are just now recognizing it in today's practice of technology, but it's been around for a long time. And that unknown gives you the ability to expand what you can do in a resource. So if on, let's be arbitrary, if on means one and off means two, if on means one and off means zero, then you string all of these zeros and ones together. We used to call them back in the days bits and bytes. If you string all this information together, you get something. But with quantum computing, you can make up stuff in a space because you don't have to commit to whether it's off or on. You have to commit that it is in use or it will be used at some point in time. So yeah, it's been around for a long time.
Yeah. Another interesting thing that I was reading about with quantum computing in regards to security, a couple things. Like one is, it's going to make math way easier. So cracking things like private keys, that's going to be much easier than it is now with just our zeros and ones. The other really interesting thing that I saw was using it for secure transport of data. So like if you're sending bits from one device to another, whether it's wireless or, you know, over a cable, a traditional method of attack is like someone reading that cable and saying, oh, well, let me see what these bits are. I'm still going to send them along, but I'm going to snoop on them. And with the, you know, the theories of quantum computing, if someone sees those bytes, then they are no longer the same bytes that they were at the time that they hit the destination. So like you may not be able to prevent people from seeing it, but you will know that they saw it because their quantum state has changed, which I don't know. It seems just like wild that that's even something that people can prove.
Absolutely. But I mean, if you think about blockchain a little bit, you know, and blockchain is supposed to be the holy grail now of saving us from all things terrible. I still think it's a long way to go with blockchain, but The fact that you have this immutable transaction. So if I send you through some financial service $20, from the time it leaves my device to the time it leaves your device, it creates a record. And that record has all kinds of things like where it came from, what it was, who it was from, and all this stuff. And then it has a destination. according to the blockchain logic, no matter what happens, whether a hacker or whoever, a thief in the night sees it, the transaction itself is intact from start to finish. And then if you in turn send me back something, and we have a series of these back and forth, and that becomes a part of the ledger. So I sent you, then you sent me, then I sent you, and so forth. And that transaction, although the money could be stolen, you could not have gotten it, you know, whatever it is, but the entire transaction, the ledger of that transaction is unchangeable. It's immutable. It is intact. So if you brought me up on charges and said, well, Rochelle said she sent me this money, but she really didn't, and, you know, whatever it is, the authorities can go then and look at that ledger and see what happened all along the way. And where really blockchain comes into a really interesting space is one with quantum computing, criminology, health, all of these pieces and parts. So for example, if someone gave me their liver or their kidney or some part of their body, that blockchain transaction from the time it's retrieved from its original host, put on a plane, a bus, or automobile, train, however it gets there, and then gets to you, that transaction again is immutable. It's exactly the same. So no matter what happens along the way, the framework of that transaction is intact. And so when you think about quantum computing, specifically what you just said about somebody seeing it. So let's just say someone saw it and said, oh, well, I'm going to change something about it and I'm going to put it back. If you wrap blockchain around quantum computing, you have almost a foolproof system of information flowing back and forth. The problem is, and you know, I think you know this probably better than I do, since time immortal, people have wanted what other people have. Mm-hmm. And so because they have, they look for interesting ways to crack, break, steal, somehow or another get this information. So if somebody comes up and robs you, that's pretty easy, right? It's just that. But you know, if someone steals your identity or steals your bank account or something, what it is, someone has really put in some extra effort to get first to find out who you are, find out who your bank is, find out what your bank account number is, find out how much money you have in your bank, and then find out a way to get it out that bank into someplace that they can use. And so that introduces Bitcoin, right? Because Bitcoin falls into that blockchain thing of an immutable currency, right? So it's this currency. But the smart people are thinking about this. The good smart people and the bad smart people are thinking about all of these things in context. And so as they're brainstorming with their friends, playing games, whatever they're doing, they're saying, what if we tried this? Or what if we tried that? And with trends in technology, we've got the good and the bad. Good people who are working to keep us safe and the people who are working us to take our things. Problem is technology has to find a way to master both sides, right? Because the good people, they're doing the best they can, but they're human beings and they're flawed. The bad people are doing bad things and they're flawed. And so the technology has to step in front of all of us and say, how do we protect the data? So how do we prevent ransomware or spy, or phishing or spyware or whatever else it is out there? How do we get in front of that? And yesterday we were having our conversation with Kirk. You know, it's really interesting to think about. Even the experts are unsure how we get to the next place where we can ensure safety. So you haven't heard of a hack or a ransomware recently. That doesn't mean they aren't happening. It's just they aren't making it to the news. So these things still go on in the background. We haven't heard a lot about identity theft, but they still happen and they go on in the background. So you've got all of these, you know, equations that are out there, and we need to figure out a way to think forward. And like the people who thought of blockchain, quantum computing and quantum theory and quantum physics and all these other things are really, really smart people. The problem is you need those people to constantly be thinking about these trends that are occurring in technology, whether we want them or not.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that brings up another, like you bring up a great point, which makes me think about how when we think about blockchain or most encryption processes now, like most encryption pieces have a public piece and a private piece. Like the private piece should never be seen by anyone except for the owner. The public piece should be public. And in theory, the public piece should never give you access to that private piece, right? Like it should be public. It should be fine. You should never be able to recreate the public. You should never be able to recreate the private from the public. And that's like solid math. Like it's a real thing. But what happens is people implement that logic incorrectly. So, you know, maybe something's not random enough, or maybe when you're generating the private piece, pieces leak out. And now all of a sudden, yeah, like the math still works. But because of all these, you know, human errors that have been introduced in this non-perfect environment that we all live in, and we all live in as non-perfect people, you know, now the math isn't quite as solid as you originally thought, or the implementation of that math isn't quite as solid.
Absolutely. And further to that point, you know, when you think about like working in an organization where you're requiring all your devices to be encrypted, you know, who has the keys? Who has the public and private keys? So we hope the end user has his or her key. But in many cases, the organization has a copy of that key too. But now, how do you share? So, okay, Drew, I've lost my, I can't get in my device. I forgot my encryption key. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those places.
Sorry, it's gone.
Right. So it's one of those places where you're kind of like, the encryption is there to protect us. But if we aren't protecting ourselves, we may be lost, because just like ransomware, if you can't get inside your encrypted device and no one else has a key, even your organization, mm-hmm. the next best thing is re-imaging or reformatting that device. You've lost everything that was there if you store it locally.
Yeah. And I think that really speaks to, like, you know, you should always have backups. Like for me personally, when I get a new laptop and that thing comes up and it says, do you want to send your key off to Apple? I say no. And it says, okay, well, here's what your key is. Print it and save it in a safe place. And I say, okay, close it, never look at it again. Knowing that if something happens, I'm going to have to reformat my laptop. Right. And like for me, that's fine. Like I would rather reformat my laptop than have that encryption key leak out somewhere, because I know, or I'm reasonably confident that most of my stuff is backed up in a way that I can get to it. Absolutely. But it's a trade-off.
It is a trade-off. And that's a very important question too. Do you back it up locally, back it up to the cloud, back it up to an external device? You've got all of those pieces and parts to think about. And you know, what Kirk was saying yesterday, which I think was a brilliant thing, you know, I was thinking about that myself. Somebody needs to be an ad hoc expert for the general public. You know, you and I had talked about this when we were talking about the Equifax breach. Like, where do people go for the answer to these questions? And if you remember my community-wide proposal I sent mm-hmm. to you, I mean, it's like, you and I have safety nets, right? We've got organizations that we work for. We've got friends who know everything there's to know about technology. You know, you've got something. But if you're just mom and pop out there and you don't have any technologists in your family, and everybody thinks that young people are so technically savvy, but what people don't recognize is they're savvy at things that cannot always protect you, right? They know how to use social media. They know how to make videos. They know how to do all these wonderful, interesting things. But can they troubleshoot a virus on your computer? Like, especially a root virus, you know, can mm-hmm. you get to that? You know what to do? Do you know how to go to safe mode? You know, all of these kinds of things that we assume people should know. But what do you do when you don't know? And what's the answer? And what I find in many cases, so I work with a lot of lawyers and judges and people who are really, really smart in one place, but technology is not theirs. They don't know what to do, so they do nothing.
Yeah. That's I've heard sort of the same for like politicians as well. It's like, you know, these politicians are not doing like, you know, incredibly technological things. They're just trying to like read their email. You know, that's like all they want to do. But it's hard, because I think both of us, we sort of were, I mean, being in technology for a pretty good while, like, you know, we sort of came up through that fire, right? Of there's viruses everywhere. You've got to figure out how to get viruses off of computers. Like nowadays, I sort of take that for granted, because knock on wood, like most boxes have virus protection of some sort on there now, whether it's like Windows Defender or, you know, OS X preventing bad things from running. Like it's pretty good. But back in the day, like you would launch Internet Explorer and you would get crazy pop-ups.
Do not launch Internet Explorer or Edge. Delete those off your computer.
So do you not like Edge, Rochelle? I've actually started using that a little bit.
You know, I think Microsoft is a brilliant company. Brilliant, brilliant company. But I don't know what, you know, when you compare Microsoft to Apple, the same concept of an operating system and applications running on that operating system exists. Why is it that almost every system that Microsoft creates has backdoors, loopholes, you know, all kinds of, you know, phony ways of doing things, and Apple does not, at least none that it makes available to their users? You know, so if I go buy a Dell computer or whomever, in my Dell computer, Edge, Internet Explorer, Microsoft Office, all of these things that are running on that machine has a backdoor. And I'm going to let you tell everybody what a backdoor is, but I have somewhere where if I'm a good hacker, I can find my way in and get at your stuff. So what's a backdoor?
So a backdoor is something where, and it's really, I mean, it's probably a product of bad software programming, but like, say you use Excel all the time, right? Like, you're a finance person, you do Excel all the time, you're always opening Excel worksheets. You know, you just love doing spreadsheets. Someone can send you an Excel worksheet that has a bad piece of code in there, right? It's just like something that's hidden in there that you never see. And because they found this like exploit that says, oh, well, you know, instead of like adding columns A and B, we want to add column A and B, and we also want to download this piece of code from the internet, and then we want to execute that piece of code from the internet, which, you know, some people may actually want to do things like that in Excel, but because it's, you know, sort of an untrusted thing, bad person sends it to you, you say, oh, I got this new Excel document, let me open it up. And now all of a sudden you think you're looking at an Excel document, but in the background, someone is launching their own code on your computer, which is then going to, you know, ransomware you. It's going to encrypt everything on your machine so that you can't get it unless you pay them Bitcoin. It could start, you know, just adding more advertisements to you so they can get these weird, like, you know, pennies on the dollar click ads. It could steal all of your data, right? It could say, hey, now I'm in this, now I'm on Rochelle's computer. I'm just going to look at all of her documents and copy them to myself and see if there's anything in there that I want to keep.
I can promise you there's not. I am so boring. but that's really, but so, okay, let me ask you this, because we all know you are the Linux guru of all time. Did you tell Apple that you created Linux and that they could hire you to be their expert? Okay,
I wish.
But you are a Linux guru. So let me ask you this question. So do you know DOS? Do you know anything about DOS?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know a little bit about DOS. That was the first computer class I took, which was, I think, in high school, and we did a little bit of DOS.
So you know how bad DOS is.
Mm-hmm.
And then what came after DOS?
Was Windows 3 next? Did they jump right to 3? Or Windows, one of those like early window managers that was built?
I don't remember which one. So there's Windows NT, then there was Windows something other, and then you got 95. I don't even remember all of them, but a lot of them.
Yeah.
But you know, when you tear apart the code, and I'll use Windows 95 because I spent a lot of time Windows 95. It is almost exactly DOS on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is DOS on steroids.
Yeah.
And so what Microsoft has done, and I don't know if they've improved that, because I have, like, Windows 10 was the last time I looked at Microsoft operating system. But there were a little bit of changes in Windows 10 that did not resemble DOS, but not a lot, but a little bit that did not. And so if you remember DOS, what did it say? Dumb operating system? I think that's what people used to call it.
Command line interface.
But there was just really no intelligence bit built into it. So now the most prevalent device sold in the market is a Windows computer. With all of these built on it, you know, I tell people this all the time. The reason why you can be in IT and go across any of the spectrum, right? Because it's copy and paste and cut and paste. Mm-hmm. It's not like they build it from the ground up, right? It's like, okay, let's scratch it and we'll start something new. You build it from, you go from this thing to that thing. So such thing, you take about system network architecture or token ring or Ethernet, cut and paste, you know, just make a few keystroke changes and you've got something else. But with DOS and all of its bugs, and it's such a popular system, it seems like to me there should be a group of people, because we all know you cannot call Microsoft on the phone. You cannot call Google on the phone. None of these people have a phone. Apparently, it's against the law to have a phone if you're one of these big companies now. And like Apple, you call Apple on the phone all the time and somebody answers. Somebody cares. I don't know how these things go amok like that. But there should be some people that are able to answer the questions for the average user who does not. So my problem did not originate where I work at. My problem is at home. You know, I'm sure you've had this in your experience in IT. So the person's home internet is not working and they want you to fix it. Mm-hmm. And they may have Spectrum or whomever they have. I'm afraid you dialed the wrong number. What? How did I fix your home internet? You know, you're at home, you know? So you've got all these pieces and parts where I still advocate for technology being smarter than technology. So it's got to find a way to think for itself to get in front of these things. So helping people out. And we've got so much to talk about in trending technology because there's the obvious, right? So we've got artificial intelligence, machine learning. We talked about blockchain a little bit. We've got quantum computer. You got robotics. There's so many things out there to think about. And how do we help the average citizen understand what that means? And one of the pieces, and I know you and I've talked about this a bazillion times, is IoT, so Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. It's lovely, lovely concept, absolutely lovely, flawed to the nth degree. It is dangerous. It is absolutely dangerous. And I do understand the federal government is working through regulations and trying to regulate it, but you've got a device that collects and sends data with no middleman, and who knows where that data is going and what happens to that data when it gets where it goes. Do you remember, you're probably way too young. Back in the old days, IBM made mainframe computers. Mm-hmm. And the mainframe computers were so wonderful, really wonderful. If a part failed, so like one of those huge disk drives, we call them DASDs, one of those huge, it would call IBM, not telling you it's doing it remotely, call IBM and say, this part has failed. Next thing you know, it'll be on your doorstep, right? And then sooner or later, the technician who's going to install it would be shortly following it, right? That sort of thing needs to be embedded in all of our technology. But instead of it calling IBM or calling the technician, it should call you and tell you you've got a problem in a way that is reasonable. So not that I can call you and tell you have a virus, because that happens all the time. But it has to be something that is a logical process to let you know something has gone amok in your system before it's too late.
Yeah, absolutely. That IBM thing reminded me of, it was when I first started working, we had a AS400 or something. It was like a miniature mainframe.
Yes, I remember AS400. Yeah.
And it was almost like they just took like two really big computers and glued them together because it was like double everything, right? Like CPU fail, that's okay. There's another one in there. We're going to send you a replacement part. You can pull it out, put the other one in while everything's still running. It's just like, oh, wow, this is like really cool. Whereas computers nowadays or servers nowadays are sort of commodity where it's like, if you have a CPU die, okay, well, that computer is going to be down like until you replace it, right? There's no, it's not going to function without a CPU. So it's sort of interesting, I guess, how that pendulum swings back and forth. The other thing I wanted to talk about when you're talking about how Spectrum is down, like maybe that is like a home thing, right? That is like a person's personal internet. But now that we are like working from home, like Spectrum being down can prevent you from like doing your job. So I wonder if like we as a tech community should maybe blur those lines, right? Like if I work for an employer and one of my employees has bad internet, like, do we just say, okay, well, like, I guess you can't work, like take sick or vacation time until it comes back up? Or do we say, okay, well, we actually need to help you get your internet going again, because,
right,
you know, it's, you know, what are you going to do without internet? Like nothing.
Right. But it's such a complicated process, right? So, you know, when you call, the first obvious question is, who's your internet provider? That question in and of itself is a complicated question for the average user. What do you mean my internet provider? Okay, who do you get your internet through? You know, keep trying to find words until you hit on something that they can say Spectrum or AT&T or Google or whoever it is that they have. Okay, you've got that part done. Great. And can you tell me, is your switch or modem or what do you call those things that they, Nest, is your, is all that working? What? You know,
oh, yeah.
So you know, you've got all of these different pieces and parts that I think that you're absolutely right. We should. The question is how do we create a standard document that we can share with the whole public that will get us past the basic things? So, right, you know, if someone calls you and says their computer's not working, your first question is, was it working yesterday? What changed from yesterday to the day, right? Is it powered on, right? You know, is your screen working? You know, you got a list of standard troubleshooting steps you can go through before you get to the meat and gravy of the thing. So the same thing has to be true for the internet. You have to have some standard set of things. So if you have a Spectrum person, if you're AT&T and Xfinity, whoever else that there is, you have to have all of these people. You have to have a standard set of questions you can ask to help the average user get through. Now, if you're at work, you know, that's, I mean, so we use Duke as an example. So I'm a Duke employee and I call you and I say, my internet is not working. So you can't use that flippant answer that we normally use when someone, one of our relatives or someone calls and says they're, and they're like, okay, call your internet provider.
Right.
I'll talk to you later, bye.
Yeah.
You know, you can't exactly say that to one of your customers or your users at Duke. So now you've got to develop a skill set for troubleshooting these kinds of problems, right? So you start with the same basic questions. Was it working yesterday? Was it working this morning? Yes, it was. Okay. Did y'all have a power outage? You know, did something happen? Did something happen in your house to take it? And depending on what the person says. So when you think about this, every time we go to approach educating the public, we've got to create a set of standards that says how we get to the bottom line. And then what do we do when we get to actual problem itself? Yeah. So he or she did not pay their Spectrum bill.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How long does it take you to get to that question, right?
So, I don't know that I would ever get there. It's right. That's hard.
Right, because you don't, that's an insult, right? You don't want to assume people don't pay their bills, but it could simply be that, you know, that they missed a day, they're 2 months later. So it could be any number of things. So how long before you get to the question that is at the heart of the problem, right? So you understand they haven't done that. And then the other piece of that, and I'm going to leave that one alone, is you may have to log into their router or their switch or something like that. Well, you can go to the internet and find the IP address for every switch or router that's ever made, right? So you can go get there. Mm-hmm. But then did the person change the password? And so I'm going to leave this part for you, because most of the providers who create these routers and switch create a password.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody in America could guess, but it's known. You know, it's not like you have to go search for it, right? So some people, smart, change that password so that not anybody can get into it. Now they don't know that password anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a, you know, that's a hard thing too. Cause like you were saying, like the passwords are out there. Like if I go to a rental house and I get on their Wi-Fi and then I see what their router is, and then I can look at the brand, I can say, okay, well, this is a router of X, you know, random router XYZ version 3, and I Google that, and then I can see, oh, well, the default username is admin and the password is also admin, or the password
right.
Or is password.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And like most people aren't going to change that, you know? Right. And if they do change it, like you said, okay, well, what did I change it to? Like, is it a password manager? Is it my super secret password that I don't really want to tell other people, even though I do want, you know, tech support to be able to get on my router? It's tough.
It is. And there's so many of these things. I mean, we're just hitting on surface, and we're kind of hopping around them, but there's so many things out there. And so while we are really interested in trends in technology, one of the trends that should be something that all technology people are thinking about is the end user and how to support that end user within these things. So, you know, I think you had talked about one time about a Raspberry Pi. I can't remember how ever it was the first time he got a robot, but Lord have mercy, that thing about drove us crazy. It would run around the house and do things. It would, you know, bump into things and all that stuff. We didn't think anything of it. We just thought it was some kind of mechanical thing that you could just, you know, press some buttons and it went about its business. But it had a little bit of intelligence in it. And I'm going to see how old you are and how much you remember. Do you remember the Furby?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so this is a kid's toy,
yeah.
Right? Had intelligence in it, right? It could blink its eyes. It could talk some bit language. I don't know what language it spoke, but it spoke some kind of, had a bit of robotics in it. So just think about that evolution coming along. All of these technologies are going to outpace each other in the marketplace, and then they're going to overwhelm their user, whoever buys it or has it.
Thank you for listening to Eminent Teachnology. If you like the show, please review, subscribe, and recommend us to your friends and family. We'd love to hear feedback from you as well. You can email us at eminentteachnology@gmail.com. See y'all soon.